Welcome to the meeting of the Commonwealth Club Member-Led Forum LGBT section. Welcomes you tonight for a very special program. Can you hear us? Giving voice to LGBT elders. At this time, I'm going to ask all of you to please turn off your cell phones or any other noise-making devices so that we can have the clearest recording for possible radio broadcast of tonight's program. The Commonwealth Club is pleased to welcome you to this very special program. We have been in existence for 108 years, sending truth free into the world. A special warm welcome to our members of the Commonwealth Club, and we hope that all of you who are not members will join us as members in the club. For all of our wonderful offerings and speaker offerings, you can go to commonwealthclub.org and see a complete listing of the programs that are upcoming throughout the year. It's our pleasure to welcome you here and always. With us tonight are four distinguished panelists. They are Brian DeVries, Gustavo Serena, Molly Steinert, and Marvin Burroughs. Each of them will have their own introduction later on. But tonight's topic is an interesting topic because the concept of LGBT participation in local, national, and global issues is now really just entering its fifth decade since the acknowledgement of gay rights during the Stonewall riots in 1969. The movement then became mainstream, and LGBT rights has made much progress and advancement in creating our communities and identities and integrating them into the larger political, social, cultural arenas in America. However, the inclusion of LGBT elders, of really listening and hearing their voices, is now something that we must now collectively consider. All the progress and inroads made in establishing LGBT identities and communities, especially in cities like San Francisco, in essence now ride on how we acknowledge and administer the specific needs of LGBT elders. It is the final imprint on a lasting LGBT participation and in leadership in our society and in our culture. We are talking tonight about increasing involvement and opportunities for LGBT elder participation in government and community organizing processes. To that end, today, some of the panel has appeared and testified before the San Francisco Board of Supervisors Government Oversight and Audit Committee to a packed room and attentive supervisors. This issue is timely, it is now ripe for our collective consideration, and it is our pleasure to have these four distinguished panelists lead us. Our first speaker is Dr. Brian DeVries, a professor of gerontology at San Francisco State University. He received his doctorate in lifespan development psychology from the University of British Columbia and was a postdoctoral fellow at both Simon Fraser University in Vancouver and the University of Southern California. He is a fellow of the Gerontological Society of America, GSA, and a board member of the American Society on Aging and co-chair of the LGBT Aging Issues Network Constituent Group. Dr. DeVries has served on the Institute of Medicine's Board on the Health of Select Populations Committee, authoring the recent and acclaimed book, The Health of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender People, Building a Foundation for Better Understanding. Dr. DeVries is former editor of Sexuality Research and Social Policy and a former associate editor of the International Journal of Aging and Human Development. He has served as guest editor of Omega, the Journal of Death and Dying, and as guest co-editor of Generations. Dr. DeVries currently is guest editing an issue of the Journal of Homosexuality, and in addition, he has edited four books, including Kinship, Bereavement in Later Life, End of Life Issues, Narrative Gerontology, and Gay and Lesbian Aging. He has authored or co-authored over 80 journal articles and book chapters and has given over 100 presentations to professional audiences on a variety of topics such as the social and psychological well-being of midlife and older LGBT persons, friendships and social relationships across the adult life course, as well as end-of-life issues and bereavement. Please join me in welcoming Dr. DeVries.
Thanks, Julian, and thank you all for being here and for this interest. I've been asked to give a sort of snapshot of the research on LGBT aging and LGBT health, and I'm happy to do so. Doing so, building upon some of the research I've done as well as that of my colleagues, and really wanting to touch on three sort of key areas, the demographic experience, physical and psychological well-being, as well as the role of stigma, which interfaces with both of those. I've prepared some notes because I'm an academic, and I could just go on, and so I'll try and keep focused to this. One of the most consistent findings, I think, in the research field about LGBT older adults, and unlike most heterosexual or non-transgender older adults, is that they're more likely to live alone, they're more likely to be single, and more likely to be without children. In our San Francisco study, for example, about three-quarters of older gay men and about half of older lesbians had no children, which is a demographic vastly different from the heterosexual population. Recent data that we've conducted also reveal that older gay men are three times more likely to live alone than are heterosexual older men, and half as likely to live with a partner. The differences between older lesbians and heterosexual women, there are differences that are less dramatic. In our national study of around 2,500 LGBT boomers and heterosexual boomers, we found that about 12% of gay men were single, never in a relationship. And this percentage was at least four times higher than those of any other group. So given that elders are first seen to turn to their spouse, then adult children, and then other family members when needs for care arise, this finding particularly places LGBT older adults, and perhaps older gay men in particular, at increased risk of having unmet needs, both social and physical. And in the absence of conventional family supports, LGBT persons have come to place a high value on friendships, what some authors have called, and with which you're familiar, sort of families of choice, or what Armistead Maupin calls logical kin in contrast to biological kin. We found that almost two-thirds of our national sample of LGBT boomers said they had a family of choice, and a high proportion said that they would turn to these friends for and offer these friends a wide range of support. In fact, they call upon their friends almost twice as often as did heterosexual boomers. Such relations, however, fall outside of typical policy and program parameters with their focus on sort of traditional family ties for care provision. That is, friends are not expected to be and often not respected as caregivers of an older adult. Moreover, friends who are mostly of comparable age may not be able or available to provide the support when need arises. And later life brings with it some particular physical and mental health issues for an LGBT aging population, in addition to all that accompanies aging more generally. For example, compared with heterosexual older adults, LGBT older adults have higher rates of disability. One national study found the rate at 45%. HIV, AIDS, asthma, and diabetes are seen more frequently amongst an LGBT population than amongst a heterosexual population. LGBT older adults are more likely to report that their health is poor, and evidence of higher rates of some forms of cancer. Gay men, for example, have higher rates of types of anal cancer and higher rates of exposure to HPV. Lesbians have higher rates of reproductive cancers. LGBT older adults are less likely to have health insurance. Boomers are less likely to have health insurance and are more likely to delay seeking health care. They have higher rates of smoking and alcohol use, and these rates are somewhat higher amongst lesbians than amongst gay men. LGBT older adults have higher rates of exposure to violence. One recent study found an average of four episodes of violence over the course of their lives, higher for gay men than for lesbians, and higher still for transgender persons. and LGBT older adults report much higher rates of depression. For gay men, for example, the rates are 2.5 times what we have found amongst heterosexual men of comparable age in the population, and 1.5 times for lesbians. Relatedly, they have higher rates of suicidal thoughts and behaviors, averaging about 3 times higher for gay men and almost 2 times higher for lesbians and bisexual women, with data that span across the life course. So stigma and discrimination really characterize the life paths of LGBT people and older persons in particular. Think of it that LGBT older adults have been labeled as anti-family and immoral by religious groups and even by their government, as a security risk or morale threat by military leaders, as sick by their doctors. These are women and men who have endured and seen AIDS decimate their social networks and destroy their communities. And these experiences of stigma and discrimination continue. A recent study published last year, for example, noted that almost 80% of LGBT older adults feel that they cannot come out in long-term care settings. And the interesting piece is that that same percentage of their caregivers and other service providers felt the same. So LGBT people and their caregivers felt that they could not come out in long-term care settings. Almost the same percentage fear discrimination by staff and other residents. Almost half fear abuse and neglect. Stigma may well underlie the differences that I've noticed. For example, psychological distress, poor health, and even unhealthy behaviors may be seen as a natural consequence of stigma, discrimination, and disdain. We found, for example, when same-sex relationships are not formally recognized, LGBT boomers are more likely to approach later life with fear and reasonably be concerned for the ways in which they will be treated in later life. This lack of recognition, though, may also be seen to have led to the important role of friend, chosen family, community, along the lines I suggested, as well as a greater reliance on and a way of doing for oneself when others have failed to do so. And herein lies some silver slivers to this otherwise dark portrait. That is, there's evidence of LGBT older adults having fashioned a sort of sense of hardiness out of a lifetime as having survived as a sexual and/or gender minority in a heterosexist environment, a sort of that which doesn't break me ultimately makes me stronger approach that may bode well in dealing with the challenges of later life. Friends and chosen family, I think, are an example of that. Almost 3/4 of our large national sample, for example, of LGBT boomers thought that being LGBT had helped prepare them for aging. A poignant example of this, I think, may be noted from a line in Harvey Fierstein's Torch Song trilogy, with which some of you will be familiar, in which Arnold, the main character, speaking with his mother, says, quote, "I can cook a meal, I can sew a shirt, I can hammer a nail, I can do whatever it takes, I can do it for myself." Arnold, as do many of us, have had to defend and create ourselves over the course of our lives, a sort of crisis competence, confronting rigid gender roles, heterosexist assumptions, and the assaults of an unwelcoming society. A better understanding of the LGBT community is not only the basis and requirement for effective and competent service provision, it offers, I think, a glimpse into how we can better engage and work with an increasingly diverse older population and challenge the pervasive what's called heteronormativity, the expectation that all develops according to a heterosexual timeline. That is, heterosexual persons can also enter old age without children, can enter old age single and or in non-marital relationships, can have a close and family-like network of friends. These are not exclusive to LGBT people. Independence is valued by most in a North American context. Policies and programs that address these effects of stigma, that include non-traditional family forms and honor diverse life trajectories, have benefits for all of us. Thanks.
You are listening. You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club. The member-led forum of LGBT section members welcomes you. On each of your seats tonight, you have comment cards. Members of the audience here, please fill out the comment card. Someone will be coming by and picking them up if you just merely hold them up and send them to me, and I will ask your question for you. Our next speaker is Gustavo Serena, who was appointed in 2004 by Mayor Gavin Newsom to San Francisco Commission on Aging and Adult Services. He served as president and later chair of finance for this commission and is currently the vice president. Mr. Serena also currently serves on the Finance Committee as a governing body member, public authority for in-home supportive services, a post since he has held since 2005. He's a president and a founding member of the Castro Upper Market Community Benefits District in San Francisco, California. In addition, he is a founding member, board member of the Rainbow Honor Walk, San Francisco, and was also the past president of the Eureka Valley Neighborhood Association. And during his tenure, the Pink Triangle Park and Memorial in the Castro District was commissioned. This is the first open-air monument in the United States to LGBT victims of Nazi Germany. He's also currently contributing as an arts writer for the Bay Area Reporter. His professional experience includes a variety of positions in finance at the Bank of America, and he holds a master's degree from San Francisco State University in early modern European history, and he also holds a bachelor's degree from the University of San Francisco. Please welcome Gustavo Serena.
Thank you very much, Julian. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. Like many of us here tonight, I never thought I'd be old. However, the alternative, dying young or prematurely, are no longer options for me. My husband, Bob Melbourne, died a little over 3 years ago, 5 weeks after we were officially married on our 42nd anniversary. He was 85, 22 years older than I, and fortunately, was spared most of the indignities that often accompany old age. He was physically active, mentally alert, had been to lunch with a friend the day before. He continued handling all the responsibilities around the house, including maintenance. His death was sudden and almost painless. He literally died in my arms. I was able to thank him for 42 wonderful years, to tell him I loved him, to say that I knew he loved me, and to reassure him that I would survive because he had been preparing me for this eventuality for some time. I kissed him and heard him take his last breath. I can only hope to be so lucky. Fortunately, we had discussed the likelihood that he would predecease me and planned accordingly. Making sure our wishes regarding health care, including end-of-life care, were expressed in legal terms is crucial. At the emergency room, the kind, gay attending physician told me that the likelihood of Bob's having a meaningful recovery from the aortic aneurysm he had suffered was remote. At best, he might live a little longer using a ventilator and other intrusive equipment. Bob's wishes in that regard were very clear, stated in his advanced healthcare directive, which gave me the authority to make decisions on his behalf, and expressed verbally to me many times over the years. Thus, I was able to carry out his wishes by telling the doctor not to take any extreme measures to save him that would result in a poor quality of life as well as extreme discomfort. While not a day goes by that I do not miss my Bob, not a day goes by without my giving thanks for the way he died and for his having made the decisions for himself. My job was to carry out his wishes. Equally important, he had made his wishes explicit regarding his estate. He had a revocable trust and a pour-over will. The first was written before we became registered domestic partners and was revised afterwards. It allowed me to settle his estate in accordance with his desires. The process was emotionally difficult, but from a legal perspective, very smooth. No one challenged the terms of his trust or the will. I also had all of my legal affairs in order, and I've had to revise my advanced health care directive my revocable trust and my pour over will to reflect the changes in my life, not only from Bob's death, but from that of my younger brother Ray, who unexpectedly predeceased me, and whom I had named to serve in various capacities should Bob not have been able to handle the necessary duties if I had become unable to care for myself. I am fortunate that other members of my biological, legal, and families of choice will follow my wishes if I am unable to manage my affairs or when I die. I cannot stress the importance of having an advanced health care directive, a durable power of attorney for management of property and personal affairs in the event you are temporarily or permanently unable to manage those affairs yourself, and having a will or a trust in place. Without them, people are at the mercy of doctors and next of kin, who at best will do what they think is right, and at worst may take advantage of the situation for their benefit. We are all going to die, and we may become incapacitated before that happens. Think about what you want and don't want done, and make those wishes explicit. With luck, you will have a trustworthy person or persons who will follow your instructions. You don't have to be wealthy to have a will. You don't have to be wealthy to name an agent to manage your personal affairs, including finances, should you become unable to do so. It is critical to plan for the worst while hoping for the best.
Our next speaker is Molly Steinert, the executive director of Stepping Stone, the largest provider of adult day health care in San Francisco that enables frail seniors and disabled adults to maintain their health and live independently in their community. She was previously executive director of Open House in San Francisco, where she led efforts to give lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered older adults better access to aging services, as well as securing the first senior housing for LGBT low-income seniors. She comes with over 30 years of nonprofit management and fundraising experience, having worked with numerous civil rights and healthcare organizations. Molly is also an appointed member of the San Francisco Long-Term Care Coordinating Council and a board member of the California Association of Adult Day Services. Welcome, Molly Steiner.
Thank you, Julian. Thank you, and good evening, everyone. It's so great to see such a great group here tonight at the Commonwealth Club. We saw a confluence today of attention on LGBT aging issues, and it's about time. It's a work that has been going on for years. It started even back in the 1980s, when the earliest LGBT adults who were coming of age began to ask, who will take care of me when I can no longer take care of myself? It's a question we all ask, and we ask it more frequently as we get older. We ask it when we see our friends who become disabled or have a sudden illness or death, and we know that we must prepare. Well, the AIDS epidemic hit San Francisco and the country and the world, and all of those plans of preparing for our aging LGBT community went up in the air for about 15 years. And then we took a breath and we came back to it. And Open House was really the first organization here in San Francisco. Marcy Edelman, the founder here tonight, really conceived and put it back on the map. And it became really a rallying cry for our community to think again about LGBT aging issues. And the first thing that we thought about was housing. And some people would ask, why housing? Well, you know, housing is health. Everyone, when they think about their vulnerability, they think about the roof over their head. That's what we worry about most. And if you look at the health prospects of people and their ability to have what they need to live well and to age gracefully, they need safe housing. And here in San Francisco, our housing is not set up for an aging community. Just about every house in San Francisco has at least 10 to 15 stairs going up to it. We have hills. We have lots of obstacles. And yet, we all want to age in the place that we know as home. And especially for the LGBT community who came here in search of home and a place where we could find family. And we did. And now as we age, we are trying fervently to keep and preserve that. Well, once you find home, then you need to find people who can help you age gracefully. Now, how many of you have been a caregiver in your life? Well, most of you have, so you know how time-consuming and physically and emotionally demanding it can be. And yet, that's what we will need around us as we become older and having to manage illness, and not just one, not just two, but many complex illnesses. And we may even have to really deal also with disabilities, mobility problems. We may have dementia that we're having to grow into Alzheimer's, and all of these make for very complex caregiving experiences. After I left Open House, I started working in adult day health, and I manage four adult day health centers called Stepping Stone in San Francisco. And some of you may know that adult day health almost was lost this past year after 30 years as an essential program that helps people remain independent as they become very, very frail. It prevents people from going into institutional care and keeps them safe in their homes. We managed to save this program, and we can continue it. And it will be essential for all of us to have these kind of care supports in order for us to remain independent. Now, I want to say something about independence. We all treasure it. It's something that we all strive to maintain, but as we get older, it can be the detriment to us, because really we need people around us. We need to be interdependent and rely on other people. But as we get older and our friends are the same age as we are, that will be very hard to rely on each other for that heavy caregiving work that is required. And so we will be needing community services like adult day health, in-home support services to patch together a system that will keep us living in our homes and cared for. We'll also need to get out of our homes, because isolation is a killer also. And we need to be engaged with other people who see us, who recognize us, who know who we are. It doesn't help to be invisible. The ask, don't tell. Don't ask, don't tell. That is not going to be part of our vocabulary. And we have to reclaim the mantra, we are everywhere, again, because that will be important for us to be visible in our community, to be recognized and connected, and to make our community services and our supports available to us. I also want to just mention that there's a rising population of our HIV, people with HIV and AIDS who are coming of age right now, who will need additional care in our community, and we must prepare for that. we are not ready to do that yet, and it's coming very, very fast. That population is going to double in the coming years. Right now it's over 50% of the aging HIV/AIDS population is in San Francisco. So it's important that we prepare not only aging services for our LGBT community, but for our aging HIV community as well. The future of aging in San Francisco can be as vital and vibrant as it is, as it was when we were growing up in this community. And it's essential that we work now to build that visibility and those connections for each other to carry us forward into our next generation. It cannot come fast enough. So I want to thank you all for coming and engaging in this conversation.
You are listening to a production of the Commonwealth Club, specifically by the LGBT member-led forum. Our topic tonight is on LGBT elders. Can you hear us giving voice to LGBT elders? Our next presenter is Marvin Burrows. Marvin was one of the founders of Lavender Seniors of the East Bay, creating social services and friendly visiting for LGBT elders all over the Bay Area. He was also one of the founders of the LGBT Lighthouse Community Center in Hayward, California. But he also works with Meals on Wheels, the Safer Schools Project of Hayward, and as a speaker and mentor for Gay Straight Alliance Clubs and other organizations, teaching about diversity and breaking down homophobia and stereotypes of older gay people. He is the Senior Community Liaison for Marriage Equality USA and UC Berkeley School of Public Health, and also the California Senior Leader Program at UC Berkeley. Mr. Burrows shares his personal story to help fight for equal rights for LGBT people. After a 51-year relationship with partner Bill Sweener, they were finally able to marry in 2004 in San Francisco, only to have this official recognition revoked a few short months later. And soon after that tragedy, Bill's untimely death was exacerbated by Mr. Burrows' subsequent loss of his home and financial security because he didn't have a marriage license. Please welcome Marvin Burrows.
Thank you. And next month, I will be 76. I have lived in the Bay Area since 1960, both in San Francisco and in the East Bay. I met the love of my life, Bill, when I had just turned 17 in 1953, and he was 15 at the time. And I moved in with him and his mother because my father told me to leave home if I continued seeing Bill. My parents knew I was homosexual when I was 15 and decided to put me in a mental home to be cured of this dreaded disease. I tried to hang myself so my family wouldn't be embarrassed that I was queer. So after the suicide attempt, instead of being committed, I was given the choice to do outpatient therapy. The psychiatrist told my mom and I that my treatment would be different than expected. He helped me to learn how to live in society, how to protect myself. I feel without him, I wouldn't be alive today. So after my dad kicked me out, I had no place to go, and I was still in school. I had to stay with my grandmother till Bill could ask his mother if I could move in with them. A few weeks before this, she had given Bill permission to buy a pet monkey. And one day, we were all sitting in the kitchen, she told Bill he had a choice, Marvin or the monkey. Well, Bill didn't answer right away, and she asked, well, and he said, I'm thinking. Well, he finally chose me, and he never let me forget that my competition was a monkey. From that time on, we tried to live as a committed couple. We bought things jointly, opened bank accounts jointly. I had limited contact with my family except for my mother and grandmother, and after a time, all my family accepted Bill as my partner or a lover. There's been so many names that we've had over the years. We were high school boyfriends, sweethearts, lovers, partners, spouses, and a short time husbands. We moved from Michigan to California in the 60s because we thought we would be better accepted in San Francisco. We did legal papers to protect our relationships in case of sickness, injury, or death as best we could at the time. We rented apartments, but had to lie about our relationship, even to the point of telling them we were related. When domestic partnerships became available in 2000, Bill and I registered. I think we were number 179. We were told that the law would take the place of any power of attorney issues. As for my involvement with Lavender Seniors, that began in 1994. Lavender Seniors was started in November 1994 by a group of about 20 seniors concerned with the lack of services and legal protections for the gay and the gray. Personally, I thought it would be a great idea so Bill and I could have an advocate, if needed, as we aged. The original meeting was held in San Leandro's Bayfair Shopping Center, and it was the inception for creating our welcoming services as well as community change. The name Lavender Seniors came about because one of the original founders put the name on a sign to direct LGBT seniors for this first meeting. From that day on, the group became known as the Lavender Seniors of the East Bay. Since the first meeting, we have determined to stick together as LGBT women and men, united. We are much stronger and we have a better time together. We also realize that we need to be widely inclusive. Lavender Seniors, therefore, warmly welcomes those who identify themselves as bisexual, members of the transgender community, those who are questioning their identities, and those who don't identify with any labels. We also deeply appreciate the support of our heterosexual friends, relatives, and allies. We host lunches in the North Oakland Senior Center, the Fremont Senior Center, with aid of both cities. We still have our original potluck in the San Leandro Community Church. We ask those who attend these lunches to become more involved, and we are somewhat successful but most have lied and lived in fear in all types of closets over the years. We are currently doing outreach to encourage local senior centers to celebrate gay pride and become more welcoming and affirming to our community. We'll be doing trainings for these senior centers. We have also done surveys at 6 senior centers in the East Bay. We also do friendly visiting to those who are homebound, and we do cultural competency trainings to agencies who deal with senior issues and to classes of social workers in several universities. For the past several years, we, along with Kaiser as a partner, we host an event called Aging in Place. Those who attend from all communities and those who are interested can, from other agencies, host a table of information. Personally, I believe that even though we have unique issues, that we should reach out to those in the general public. In 2004, Bill and I were married when the mayor of San Francisco gave us that opportunity. At that time, we had been together for 50 years. We were very surprised how emotional we became during the vows. To be able to speak those words out loud in front of others brought tears to our eyes. No doubt that ceremony changed and revitalized our relationship. It gave us a measure of pride and acceptance. 500 other marriages were performed that same day and over 4,000 over the month when it was allowed. It felt great to be able to do something so personal and so political all at the same time. And Anna knows that Mark Leno is the guy who performed that ceremony. However, all those marriages were declared null and void 6 months later by the California Supreme Court. When the California Supreme Court declared that we could get married a few years later, it was too late for Bill and I, for Bill had died in 2005 of a heart attack. I called the cremation service that had taken care of my mother when she passed away, but was told that since I did not have the right to dispose of his body, and since I did not have a current power of attorney, we were considered roommates. I tried to explain that since we were registered domestic partners, I had that right, but I was still denied. The Hayward policeman who was staying with me after the paramedics left suggested I call the Neptune Society, and I had no problem with them since they were aware of the new 2005 domestic partner law. Bill had also signed me up for his insurance and his pension benefits. Since I did not have the protections of marriage, I was denied his pension, but I did get his life insurance. And I had to move from our home of 35 years, lost the health benefits I had through his union, which Bill had to pay income tax on, and I did not, of course, receive his Social Security benefits. When I called the Alameda Cremations Company to take care of my mother when she passed away, I was still denied. I was told that, that's a repeat. A wonderful friend in the audience tonight, Frank Howell, previously lost his partner of 25 years, and after I lost my home, he offered to share his home with me. Almost 3 years later, I got a call from NCLR, who had tried to help me get Bill's pension, told me that the union changed their policy, and I would now be able to collect his pension checks. They even went as far as to make it retroactive to the date Bill died. Now that the voters have taken away the right for our community to marry, it has created a confused mess. Opposite sex, of course, can marry. Same-sex couples who married during that short window are still married. Unless one dies or the divorce, then they can't marry again. I cannot marry, so I went from second-class citizen to third-class citizen. I do believe that one day we will be allowed to marry in every state. It may not happen in my lifetime, but it gives me hope that no one will have to go through what I did when I lost the love of my life. I hope I have made a difference in improving the lives of LGBT seniors by telling my story to healthcare providers and policymakers in an effort to change laws and procedures that protect LGBT seniors from being invisible and underserved. I also volunteer by delivering Meals on Wheels and advocating around issues that affect all seniors by speaking with legislators, attending community forums, and most of all, by being visible as a senior, Lavender Senior, at LGBT community and senior outreach events. My advice to other LGBT seniors, get civically engaged. Civic engagement has helped me to live a fulfilled life as a gay senior because it gives my life purpose. Thank you.
You are listening to a program by the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is on LGBT seniors, entitled Can You Hear My Voice? To the panelists as a whole, thank you so much for each of your testimony and for your witness here tonight. So it's interesting because nobody ever thinks that they're going to get old, as you said, Gustavo. But I'd like to ask each of the panels, when did you first seriously start thinking about senior issues and, as a subset, specifically LGBT senior issues?
Me? When I first started getting stuff from AARP, I think it was 50. And I said, uh-oh.
I would say it really started maybe when I was taking care of my father after he had a stroke, and I saw how complicated it was for my mother, who basically became a full-time caregiver.
When I met Bob, he had two very close friends who had been together a long time, but they were a great deal older than he was, and I watched Loring as he began to decline in his 80s. And at the time that he died, I was working at Bank of America, and they offered long-term care health insurance. I was 35, and I signed on the line. And I'm still able to get it as a Bank of America retiree.
I did my PhD in lifespan developmental issues, and so across the life course in later life was always sort of a focus for me. I grew up with my grandmother living in our household, and I had this image of a healthy, vibrant, active older woman, and then these stereotypes of that defied that. And even as a kid, that sort of incongruity between what I witnessed and what I heard sort of motivated me, I think. But that's a more professional. Personally, You know, I think when I started being called sir or by a formal name rather, you know, as a professor, I used to, in my classes, talk about our experiences. And one of my students said, "But what was it like when you were young, Dr. DeVries?" And then I realized our experiences differ. And
let's talk about what it's like to be LGBT and senior in San Francisco for a moment. Apparently, one in six seniors are LGBT in San Francisco, and while there is a huge need to expand innovative services in San Francisco, in what is called a progressive city, there are gaps, especially for low-income LGBT seniors. What is being done in the city and county of San Francisco to address the needs of LGBT seniors?
I'll answer. Well, one of the very first steps that Open House took was to create culturally competency trainings for our senior service agencies. It's very important that we integrate into our existing senior services. We don't really have the luxury to create a whole new LGBT aging service organizations. And I mean, during the AIDS epidemic, we did. We created what we needed, and we did very quickly invent all the services that we knew we had to have, but we can't do that with aging. We will have to fit into in-home health services, into adult day health, into the transportation, the food programs, all of the programs that currently exist. And that is a process that happens over and over and over. You don't just go to one agency once. You go two and three and four times. It really takes time for those principles of who we are, what our lives are like, to sink in. And if you can imagine how vulnerable a transgender woman may be to accept someone to come into her house, to bathe her, to dress her, who may not have any awareness of who she is, and she may feel judged, stigmatized, she will reject that service. She will rather live on her own independently than accept that kind of care. So we must do that kind of work now, and we still have much to do in that area.
Since I've been on the Commission for Aging and Adult Services, I'm pretty sure I was the first openly gay commissioner to serve, and I certainly was the first openly gay president of the commission. Through Open House, a marvelous woman named Nancy Flaxman came to talk to the commission to explain the issues of cultural competency, and we were able to fund programs at the Castro Senior Center that were targeted to LGBT seniors, programs that have been duplicated at the 30th Street Senior Center, at Bernal Heights, and elsewhere in the city. At the Castro Senior Center, we had people come together who had been going to the center on their own, but now were able to come on one Tuesday of the month for programs directed at them. And they formed friendships. They began to check on one another. Those who were able to drive would take their newfound friends to the doctor or shopping. They began to form a community, and they were very diverse. They didn't always agree on things, but they were there for one another. It was a remarkable thing to see, and it took very little money. It just was a question of making that connection. Nancy set that program up, and it is going strong. So the Department of Aging and Adult Services in San Francisco is extremely sympathetic, extremely supportive, and we're very lucky in that regard. Ann Hinton has done a wonderful job.
How do you reach an individual who is scared to identify as LGBT or has never accessed services from the city before or has otherwise a personal block between coming out as somebody in need? and specifically a senior LGBT person. What do we do then?
Actually, I'll defer to Molly. I think as a researcher, that's been a critical issue for us, right? I mean, how is it that do we count LGBT older people? The census doesn't. I mean, there's no federal survey that addresses sexual orientation or gender identity. We could look at same-sex households in the survey, but as we see, that's a minority of LGBT people. And so I think it's an issue that has deep effects on research, but the more practical response, I wonder if Molly might be better to address.
Well, this is a question that has perplexed our organizations over and over, to break down that barrier, that fear. We have, in some ways, our LGBT organizations have generationally been isolated from each other. So the elders who are in their 80s and 90s are not always connected to the LGBT generation that followed them. And we are waking up to realizing our own aging, and there's another track going on of the elders who have been aging all along. So we're needing to make contact. That's why intergenerational work is so important, and I see it happening now. But we didn't do it when we were in our, 30s and 40s in our community. We really lived on two separate tracks in many ways. And so creating programs in the neighborhoods is really important. We reach people who are... They don't have to come downtown to visit the organization or to go to a meeting at night when it's not easy to get out. We do programs in the neighborhoods, in the senior centers. We reach out to people next door in our communities that we know are gay, and we make contact. And we do it in ways that are repetitious, so we can create that openness and help.
And I also think that we should encourage any agency who deals with any senior issues to put it in their intake, make a list of who we are, how do we identify ourselves, and I think that would open up some doors that were closed before.
I also think that we as a community, particularly gay men, need to acknowledge that we have internalized America's ageism. And we tend to value and admire young people and frequently marginalize ourselves as we get older. I don't think the gay community is quite willing to face the truth of that. One way to counter it, one thing that I have done, and it was something that Bob urged me to do, was to get involved in neighborhood affairs. I had never done that. I'd been too busy with my career, and I really didn't have time. But he went, and I went with him. And consequently, I have made friends, gay and straight, who are younger than I am, who are in their late 40s and their 50s, and who regard me as a peer, who think that I have something to offer, who socialize with me, who have been there to celebrate and to mourn. And I urge us all to get involved in our community, because that is the way we will meet people of all generations. And we will be able to help them and help do away with some of the unfortunate stereotypes that gay men in particular deal with as we get older. It seems to me, and this is a generalization, that lesbians are more forgiving. They're more charitable and they're more generous.
Well, let's talk about the age difference and the perceptions between the different groups. Do you perceive, and can you speak to the perception that there's a growing division between younger gay people with children and an older cohort or generation of LGBT people without children? Extra credit for answering that question.
I don't know that that's true. There are a lot of same-sex couples in my neighborhood with children. And I'm delighted to see them, and they seem to be delighted that I'm enjoying their children. I think that many of them are aware of what we have done to make what they're enjoying now possible. And I think that for me, the idea, for example, of having, if I had had a child of the type that I was, I probably would be in jail for infanticide. But because I was an extraordinarily difficult child, but I was blessed with remarkably tolerant and loving parents. But I think that if we approach same-sex couples with children and let them know that we are celebrating what they're doing, they might like to have multi-generational household friends for their children to enjoy.
My story is a little bit different. For the last 17 years, I've been a chaperone at gay prom in Hayward. So I have a rapport with the young people. And one year, the young people gave us chaperones a prom. And that was really, really a nice gesture.
Dr. DeVries, you asked, you had a lot of statistics. Is there a website that we could go to look at the statistics for ourselves? But more than that, is it that the maladies that you described for LGBT older adults a result of LGBT people being more conscientious in their reporting, or is there an actual real incidence that is higher because perhaps higher incidence of smoking and alcohol abuse during their younger years?
I think it's a great question, and I think it's both. I think that there's a greater sensitivity, I think, to our bodies amongst LGBT people, and as a consequence, there might be a higher likelihood of recognizing that which afflicts us and perhaps reporting. But I think also we live with in a culture of minority stress, that we live our lives as stigmatized men and women, and there's a cost to that, and that heavy weight that we carry around with us, wondering at every turn, is it safe to be who I am in this setting, has a lot of physical and psychological costs. And so I think it's both. I think there's a sensitivity to it, and there's also a weight that's applied as a function of being LGBT and aging. As for the statistics, there's a variety of places where you might go. For one of the reports that we prepared last year from the Institute of Medicine is really a comprehensive state-of-the-art compilation of all of the documents, all of the research has been published on LGBT health, including LGBT later life. It can be downloaded for free from the National Academies Press. And so you could go to the National Academies Press website and download the LGBT report. And the American Society on Aging, the LGBT Aging Issues Network, has a clearinghouse for LGBT documents that are publicly available, more depth available as a membership of ASA. And there's also the new AOA-funded LGBT initiative that will also have documents available too.
So let's do a round robin. So I'm going to ask you for a one-word response. And the one-word response is to answer this question. What is, in your opinion, the greatest unmet need of LGBT seniors? Okay, once we start, I'll give you a moment to think about this, but once we start, we're just going to go right down the line. Okay, so Marvin, you're looking at me.
Acceptance.
Molly.
Visibility.
Gustavo.
Visibility.
Brian.
Authenticity.
How about a word? How about a hand for all four of them? Brian, you raised an interesting question or issue on authenticity. The stigma for coming out is pretty universal wherever we are, whoever we are. But do you find a geographical imbalance so that people who are actually in the larger city or in a major metropolitan area find it easier to come out as LGBT as opposed to people who are in more rural, more conservative areas of the country?
Do we know a lot less about non-urban settings? And so that's a difficult answer. I was an examiner for a dissertation on rural older gay men. And that they were known to each other, even not as identified as gay. And so I think that there's a culture that establishes and where people recognize each other and find the community, but not identify as LGBT. But even in the urban centers, I think there's a lot of variability in the extent to which people feel comfortable or able to come out. And there's still evidence of, excuse me, men in, with research with which I'm familiar, men in their 60s, 70s just now coming out. And so it remains a lifespan developmental process, I think, and it varies by urban, rural, geographic sort of issues, but also a lot that's really been understudied by culture and race. We have some evidence that there's differences in the extent to which you're out as a function of racial identity, with Caucasians being out to a greater degree than members of other racial ethnic minorities. And the diversity that exists within our community is only now beginning to be talked about, and there's a lot that needs to be done on that, I think.
Unfortunately, the time has come for our last question. The last question is, what do you think, or what have you been told, is the best part of being an LGBT senior?
That we're
Gustavo?
Unique.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Marvin.
I just think that we're unique.
Well, I think we've defined who we are all of our lives, and we've created a community, and I think we have the potential to do it again, to make it special, unique, and vibrant for ourselves.
I came out to my family when I was 21, and I'm very fortunate that my brothers and their wives raised their children to treat me with respect and affection, to regard Bob as their uncle. And now my youngest nephews and my grandnephews shake their heads in bewilderment when they learn about homophobia, when people put down gay people. It is shocking to them. When my youngest nephews visited us the last time, one of them was very attentive to Bob. And I said, Anthony, thank you for being so kind to him. And he said, but of course, he's my uncle too.
I think the burdens that come with living as a minority have a lot of costs. And the flip side of that is that we have the freedom then to develop processes and relationships and ways that best serve us. I think we see that in the way in which we form friendships and community. We saw that in the response to AIDS and how the community really addressed a need that was shamefully not addressed by the government. And I think we could do the same with aging. I think that we have the opportunity to change the face of aging. It doesn't have to be heterosexual, identified principles and practices that exist in institutional settings. We could do it differently. We've shown that we've done a lot differently over the course of our lives, and I think that this remains another place where we could have an impact.
Thank you. You have been listening to a program from the Commonwealth Club of California, produced by the member-led forum of LGBT members at the Commonwealth Club called Can You Hear Us? Giving Voice to LGBT Elders. Our thanks tonight to our distinguished panelists, Brian DeVries, Marvin Burrows, Gustavo Serena, and Molly Steinert. Thank you for being our panelists. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, which has been sending truth free to the world for 108 years, is over.